I'd just like to introduce, I'd like to say thank you very much first and foremost to Dr. Erica Mallory Blythe for spending her time and coming over to do this free presentation. I'd also like to thank this the lady at the back who is giving me plenty of support, okay? And also to Michael Clark at the back who helped me finance this, okay? Okay. Well, you have to be I'm a bit nervous during presentations myself. Okay, so I'd just like to talk about Dr. Erica Mallory Blythe. She's a special expert at the International Commission of Biological Effects of Electromagnetic Fields. And she's a founder of Physicians Health Initiative for Radiation and Environment, which is called FIRE. Okay. She's a UK-trained medical doctor with a decade of experience within hospital medicine. Emergency trauma medicine was her area of expertise in hospital. And in training for this speciality, she has a broad base of medical experience, including surgery, anaesthetics, obstetrics, pediatrics, and intensive care, both neonatal and adult. She has worked in hospital emergency rooms, led trauma teams, taught on trauma medicine courses throughout the UK and abroad, and was selected to instruct doctors on teaching within medicine for advanced trauma and life support, ATLS. Okay, so in 2008, she began researching biological effects of non-ionizing radiation with a special interest in electromagnetic hypersensitivity. She's been invited to lecture globally on this issue and discuss the public health issues surrounding non-ionizing radiation exposure at the highest political level, both in the UK and in Europe. She formally transitioned from clinical medicine to full-time research in 2015 and founded FIRE to facilitate education on a larger scale. The group is currently constructing best practices guidelines for non-ionizing radiation health safeguarding for multiple settings, including hospitals, schools, and workplaces. Okay, so I'd like to introduce Dr. Erica Mallory Blythe, please.
So this is the group that I put together some years ago to try to increase awareness and education on the issue of non-ionizing radiation, because this area of medicine has not so far been taught comprehensively to medical doctors. In fact, most have received no real training on this at all. These are my declarations, and so you'll see that I'm affiliated I'm a special expert at the International Commission on Biological Effects of Electromagnetic Fields. And I'm going to speak to you today about non-ionizing radiation health with a focus on the vulnerabilities of children. Now, this might seem a very basic question to open with. What keeps our children healthy? But it's actually a really, really important question that I am concerned we've lost sight of a bit in the modern world. Some of the basics, and when I say basics, to get a child through a few hours, a few days, we need these basics. They need oxygen, water, shelter and food, of course. But to get them further, that's acutely, that's in a short space of time, for chronic good health, long-term good health, we need more than that. We need clean breathing air, and it's a subject of a lot of discussion at the moment, how many children are reacting to contaminated air. And that can be one of the factors implicated in asthma, for example, that can take the lives of our children. So we also need clean water and dietary optimization if we want them to flourish. They need to have good sleep. And this is something we don't talk about, in my opinion, nearly enough. You'll all be familiar with the term sleep like a baby, but it is actually quite a serious problem that many, many children are not sleeping well in current society. Of course, they need exercise for good, strong bones, and healthy clothing is something that is being discussed more, because the skin absorbs chemicals extremely well. It's very efficient. It's the body's largest organ, and so we need to think about what we're putting close to the skin of our children. And of course, personal care products, which again have attracted more and more interest, because so many children now are sensitive to their everyday care items, whether it's their laundry detergents or the lotions and potions for moisturising and hygiene and cleanliness. Love and emotional support never been more important. Perhaps we should have that in that first set of four at the top. And, of course, natural light, again, the subject of a lot more discussion. A lot of evidence now about the way light affects our biology. And you'll all know about the discussions on blue light that are coming up around the discussions of tech. So this dovetails in beautifully with the last thing on our list, that we need, if we want them to flourish, an uncontaminated electromagnetic environment as well. And that is the focus of my talk with you today. Now, you're not naive, I'm sure, of the fact that this is a controversial issue. And scientific dispute is really healthy. It's what drives us forward to find the answers when there's a, especially when there's a rapidly evolving new subject. So this is a good thing. But it's interesting to me that in this particular debate, we've got some degree of polarisation. And there are three groups, really. The largest group by far is a group of people who actually don't know anything, really, about this issue from a scientific perspective. That is the largest group. Then we have two groups, if you like, of experts who do know a lot about this issue. But one group who say we've got no reason for concern at all. The tech-related electromagnetic fields that are proliferated in our environment are perfectly safe. We need not fear them. And another group who says, no, we don't think these are safe, and we think that children are at particular risk. So we're now going to delve into that science in a fairly short space of time. So over the next hour or so, I've been told it can be quite relaxed with timing, so I thank you for that. But I'm going to try and give a very brief overview of the electromagnetic spectrum and devices that use it, the intrinsic electromagnetic nature of life itself, safety limits, and the evidence for biological interaction of electromagnetic fields, and the some common misconceptions, conclusions moving forward, and then we have, again, a nice, generous amount of time for discussion and questions following this. So this is a bold, big question also for the beginning of a presentation like this, but the reason I pose it here is because without overthinking this, in a very simplistic way, in my previous roles in the emergency department or in intensive care, this becomes very, very simple. And actually, electromagnetism in that situation quite literally means the difference between the presence of life or absence of it. We look for these fields, the electrocardiogram, the ECG, the brain waves, the EEG, and the shape of those waves and the presence of them tells us whether there is resurrectable life in an organism that otherwise appears lifeless. So you could say from that simple point of view that EMF is quite literally the essence of life. With that in mind, it's no surprising that all areas of the electromagnetic spectrum do interact with biology. We don't just have these outward signs of EMF from our heart and our brain because that's the way our cells function, it's how they communicate. We're two-way transmission antennas. We actually receive cues from our environment, very subtle sometimes, like light for regulation of our sleep-wake cycle, our circadian rhythm. And these are essential to good, healthy progress through life and optimizing health. So all of you will be aware that ionizing radiation up here, the blue part of this spectrum, is well known to damage health. This is why we have so much precaution over x-rays, for example, when they're used in hospital. But for many years, we were led to believe that everything below that point in the spectrum was relatively inert, when in fact, all of these areas interact, like blue light does in the middle there, the radio frequency and microwave frequencies that we use for our wirelessly communicating devices. These also affect biology, as do the extremely low frequency fields in our household wiring, driving the lighting circuits in here now, in the high tension, high voltage power lines outside. So all of these are important for us to think about, and I'm going to focus particularly on the radio and microwave portion, but we'll touch on some of the extremely low frequency as well. So these are common devices that communicate wirelessly, and more come on the market quite literally every few seconds, I think, every minute, every hour, including devices marketed specifically for children and sometimes devices, wearables even, for newborn babies. So, and of course, we now have exposures from cradle to grave, but really from conception to grave. Many people keep their phones in their pockets, very close to where a developing fetus will be. So although this tech has proliferated extremely rapidly, we obviously need to continuously question whether this changing environment is safe for those growing children. Now, one of the things that's purported to allay concerns in this arena is that you don't need to worry because radio frequency radiation was around before the dawn of man. It's natural. That's quite a gross distortion of the truth on this because of the great increases we've seen in the intensity of that kind of radiation. So the Goldilocks zone, as it's called, but this very delicate balance that we have here on planet Earth, where everything must be just right, is very precarious. And movements, even slightly in one way or another, with our environment can have profound biological effect, not just for humans, but for the wildlife around us. And we'll touch on that in a moment too. So natural, as it's implied, radiation is can be found to be quintillion times lower than some of the intensities that we see around us now. And this is a publication from the Lancet Journal of Planetary Health. And you can see that this was natural background radiation, green here, dipping at around a gigahertz. And that is the very area of the spectrum that we have filled in with these anthropogenic or man-made new radio frequencies. And this is a logarithmic scale, so the difference between this dip, this natural radio quiet zone, and these much higher intensities that we now see is really substantial. But you would all expect, as I most certainly did throughout my work in the NHS, that there are robust safety limits in place to protect us. And what do we expect from those? Well, we expect that they will protect our biology and those whom we love, our children who are growing, and the wildlife around us, that it will be inclusive with a substantial safety margin. That's what we expect. Unfortunately, the ICNRP guidelines, which are currently used in many countries, do not consider what we call non-thermal effects. They occur below orders of magnitude in some cases, below tissue heating or thermal effects. So what you might not realise is your microwave oven operates on the same sort of frequency band as your mobile phone. It's just that it's at a much lower intensity in the case of the phone. But if you increase those intensities, you do get tissue heating. The problem is that we also get a whole load of other biological effects that happen many orders of magnitude below those heating levels. And those safety limits were only designed to stop against a certain level of temperature rise in your tissues. So my colleagues and I at the International Commission on Biological Effects of Electromagnetic Fields, or ICBE-EMF, in this case .org to find the website, have put together this publication, and that's where you can find this publication. And I want to draw your attention to it because many of the references in there will support some of the important points I'll be making throughout this. And rather than stop and keep giving you new references, this is a great collection of references, and it's quite a recent paper. So in this, we point out a whole list of invalid assumptions which underlie the current guidelines. And because it's quite science heavy and not digestible to everyone necessarily, we've also put together a fact sheet. And in that fact sheet, we've got some of the most basic points laid out in a very digestible fashion. This pictogram just gives a clue on the 14 assumptions that we've pointed out that we think are invalid underlying these safety guidelines and need to be addressed for guidelines to be truly protective of your biology. And I'm in this short presentation, I'm actually only going to talk about these two. So I'm going to talk about vulnerabilities of children, and I'm going to talk about variations in sensitivity, which happens both in adult populations and in child populations. In this paper, that's assumption 7 and 8. So the group that I mentioned, ICNRP, they're the ones who set the guidelines that many countries are using. And they pointed out quite rightly in 2002 that they expected there to be variations in tolerance. So that children, the elderly, for example, and chronically ill people with comorbidity or underlying illnesses could all be more vulnerable to this kind of radiation. And they questioned, well, perhaps we need separate guidelines to encompass those groups. But they also anticipated the possibility of failure, where there were concomitant exposures to synergistic toxicants, for example, other toxic substances in the environment that could interact with the electromagnetic fields and cause elevated biological damage. And that is certainly something that we see in an increasing number of publications. So they were right to be concerned about that. And they also, as I say, pointed out that some may be more sensitive than others. But what's disappointing is, unfortunately, they abandoned these very important principles. And you can see in their fact sheet from 2020 that, in fact, they used the adult exposure levels to set the restrictions for children, and they made no separate accommodations for those who have higher sensitivity levels. So one of the reasons that they decided to use the adult limits for kids is they said, well, the core body temperature of a child does not rise to any higher level than that of an adult. Children have quite good thermoregulation within their physiology, so they can compensate in the same way that adults do when there is something trying to heat them up. And they basically said, since they're not heating up any more than adults are, that's okay. That means that everything's all right. We don't need to worry about anything else. As someone who's worked as a medical doctor practicing clinically for many years, I found that really, really surprising, because it's a huge oversimplification of how biology works to think that only heating, by the way, of more than a degree. So it's not that there's no heating allowed. You're allowed up to a degree of core body temperature and higher than that in the peripheries. So I wasn't the only one who questioned whether this was reasonable. And this is from before that, actually. This was in 2002, but the US Environmental Protection Agency, just in the last line here, you'll see the generalization by many that the guidelines protect human beings from harm by any or all mechanisms is not justified. And I would say that statement is still as factually correct today as it was then. Because it's not simply about temperature, either in the adult population or in child populations, but children are more vulnerable because of their unique anatomy, tissue dielectrics, and physiology. And we'll talk a little bit more about these issues as we move through. Now, I pointed out one publication that I think is really important for you to read if you want a lot of references on this subject, and that is particularly pertaining to the exposure limits. This paper is heavily looking at the specific vulnerabilities of children. So this is Deborah Davis et al., again, very recently published. And this is a large paper that goes into a lot of detail and will give you a lot more references, again, about the specific, unique situation with child health. And from that publication, I have taken a graphic with their permission, which I think is very useful to those who want to understand this from a mechanistic point of view. I know we have some medical doctors and medical physicists and engineers in the audience, and we've become very reductionist in both science and medicine. And there are some pros to this and some cons. So this means we like to understand if it appears that A causes B, we like to see all of the steps between A and B before we accept that that's valid, an evidence-based approach, which I think is extremely important on the one hand. Equally, when overwhelmingly the evidence shows us that A causes B, but we're not entirely sure yet of all the steps in between, we obviously shouldn't let that necessarily stop us taking important public health measures, which is one of the problems we've had in this particular subject. But looking at mechanisms, so this is the graphic that I was mentioning from that paper by Davidovis et al. And you'll see up at the top here, both when we look at chronic exposures, that means long-term, and acute, short-term exposures, you'll see the term ROS. That stands for reactive oxygen species. That is oxidative stress, and we'll talk quite a lot more about that over the coming slides. So that is one of the mechanisms implicated in how we get from A, the EMF exposure, to B, the biological damage. And if we were going to try and put everything that's been published on the subject of mechanism into this diagram, it would look unreadable on a slide. But this is a great summary of some of the areas where the evidence is very strong. And so they're looking here, you'll see a word over down here that says apoptosis. That is cell death. Now, some studies show increased cell death with electromagnetic field exposure. Some show inhibition. And you might think, well, inhibition of cell death has got to be great. We'll all live forever. But that's not quite how it works. Apoptosis is a very, very important process which allows cells to be deleted when they're defective. So if you stop that process happening, then what you end up with is defective cells that should have been deleted that are not. And, of course, that can increase risk of cancer. So that's why we see cancer in the box down here. Looking down the other side of that diagram, you'll see in the middle there the effects on the body barriers. We have a blood-brain barrier and a blood-testis barrier and a blood-gut barrier and the eye. There's many, many barriers that are very important for the healthy function. And this can damage some of those barriers. And there are many, many more things that I could add to this mechanistic discussion. But feel free to ask more about that in the questions at the end. So oxidative stress is one of the mechanisms that we're concerned about. And you might ask yourself rightly, okay, so it's something we're looking at, but how strong is this evidence? And now back in 2015, Igor Yakimenko and colleagues looked at the number of papers they found that showed oxidative stress. And what they found was this was very robust. 93% of papers they looked at, and they looked at over 100 papers at that time, showed that there was the effect of oxidative stress below the exposure, allowable exposure thresholds. This was republished again in the Lancet Journal of Planetary Health, and they looked at, in this case, 216 out of 244 papers, and again showed that this had a very high reliability in terms of a genuine mechanism. And my the group that I work with, ICBE, we have published this again. So that reference I gave you at the beginning, you'll find in that reference that we saw 124 out of 131 papers. This is Yakimenko again, is part of that group, showing this phenomenon of oxidative stress. So I would say this is extremely factual. It's well proven that this is an effect from EMF exposures below allowable guidelines. Now, oxidative stress is important as a mechanism. The reason I've drawn your attention to this particular one is because it's implicated in all of your different biological systems. So all of these diagnoses and many, many more have been implicated in some published papers as having an oxidative stress component that can increase risk. Now, looking specifically at the EMF aspect of this, it's no surprise then that what we see is that multiple systems do appear to be affected, and there's literature now showing effects in all of these areas and many more, particularly the central nervous system. We see a lot of CNS effects, and of course your central nervous system governs all of your other systems to some extent. So you can see secondary effects on those systems, and also we seem to see direct effects separately on different cell lines that are specific to other systems. So all of these medical diagnoses and some others have been linked in some way, shape or form with EMF exposure in the literature, some strongly, some weakly, and there are more that aren't on this slide. But when I put this slide together many years ago, I roughly tried to think of things that were perhaps more in childhood populations on the left and in adult populations on the right. And what I've been sad to witness over the years is how these adult issues, you know, neurodegeneration, dementias, we're seeing this in younger and younger adults. It's often said, or the reason this is such a worry is because we have an increasingly aging population. But actually, that doesn't explain the figures that we're seeing, because we're seeing them in much younger adults than we used to. And cancer, migraines, depression, insomnia, these are things that we're seeing more and more in our children, which is extremely concerning. We have to be searching. Why are these things escalating? When we supposedly know more about biology and medicine than we've ever done before, why are so many different forms of sickness increasing in both child and adult groups? So multiple chemical sensitivity, I'll just mention this for a moment because I'm not dwelling on this in this talk, but I said at the beginning, you know, we've got this increasing number of children who have allergies to various different things, hypersensitivities to foods and cosmetics, etc. And this has been linked with this here, electromagnetic hypersensitivity. And this on the right is a subject of specialist interest of mine. So I'm just going to say a few more words about this, because this is something that can make some children even more vulnerable than simply their young age. So some of you may have heard of electromagnetic hypersensitivity, or EHS. It's gone by many names over the years, and it's actually something which isn't that new. So isthmic syndrome, microwave syndrome, radio wave illness, these are all actually describing the same thing and have been described back for many decades. And some of you will know this in a different way. You might know people who say, oh, I always get headaches when it's thunderstormy, or I don't get on well with fluorescent lights, etc. Those are all different forms of this that are often not recognised. And we can't simply brush this under the carpet either. We can't trivialise this, because a surprising number of people are affected. The EESC in 2019 suggested that 3 to 5% of the population were suffering with this. And we see other figures even up to 10 or 12% from some countries. Why is the prevalence so variable? Well, I would say that's because this is a spectrum, a bit like autistic spectrum disorders. This is something where we see mild, moderate, and severe cases. And if you look purely at severe cases, this might be less than 1%. But if you look at very mild cases, most of which are probably undiagnosed, that would be people who are just getting headaches and they're not sure why, or people who are not sleeping brilliantly, they don't know why. And those cases could be a surprisingly large proportion of the population. Because doctors aren't trained on this, it's not something they think of when someone comes in, even if they come in with the classical constellation of symptoms. And these are common symptoms that can have other causes, but when you put them all together, you should be thinking, could this be what's behind it? And when I say classic constellations, this is from the WHO in about 2005, and they pointed out nervous system symptoms and pricking, burning sensations, rashes, a very objective sign. And they say here, whatever its cause, EHS is a real and sometimes disabling problem for the affected individuals. Their exposure, EMF exposure, is often several orders of magnitude, I'll make that bigger so you can see it, below the internationally accepted standards. So the question here I would ask is, why have they said whatever its cause? Because surely it is what it says on the can, it's two electromagnetic fields. Well, the question mark here is raised because a certain set of groups feel that this is purely psychological. That it's just because people are scared of their cell phones, that's why they get the headaches, or they're frightened of their Wi-Fi, that's why they get dizziness, or heart palpitations, or skin rashes, that all of that is because of concern, rather than a genuine biological effect. So that's called the nocebo response. It's the sort of darker brother, if you like, of the placebo response, which we use in medicine all the time. And these kind of responses are theoretically true. Placebo can be very powerful, in fact. But the question is, are they the cause of these symptoms in this case? And there are major problems with this theory. So from a clinical perspective, if you ask a doctor to talk to somebody with a new set of symptoms and try and get to the bottom of it, they take a very specific set of approaches. But the first thing is just to talk to them, find out who they are, and you know, talk about what their problems are. And when you do this with people with EHS, so often what happened was their symptoms came first before any concern at all. They're often technophiles who love technology, and in fact took them a while to work out that's what was causing it until it got so bad, because in severe electromagnetic sensitivity, it's really not confusing, because they'll pick up a phone, they get immediate symptoms. Or they go and try to use a computer, they get immediate symptoms. And as the WHO pointed out, sometimes utterly disabling symptoms. So for those that get very severe, it's really obvious to them what the cause is. And this sometimes technophilic group are then horrified. They can't do their job. You know, they struggle to even have good recreational social life. And so they keep trying to use the devices. That's not in the slightest bit consistent with the nocebo sort of fear response. It just doesn't fit. In addition to that, there is something that we call double-blinded provocation studies. So insights, if we want to really separate those causes, psychological from physical, one of the things that you would think let's do is let's blind them and then give them an EMF exposure and see if they react. Now, technically, that sounds like it would be a great way to separate those two. In reality, it's actually very hard to do this kind of studies, especially on large groups of people. So, but nonetheless, in some of these studies, that reaction has actually been shown. There's a long list of reasons why it's difficult to show. And I'll give you a bit of an example. But imagine you have a child where you're suspicious they've got a dairy intolerance. Because you've noticed that they get an upset tummy quite regularly, not long after they've had a bowl of cereals with milk or something like this. This is a common thing. Mum goes to a GP and GP says, you might be right, cut out dairy, see if your child gets better. You cut it out, the child gets better, no more upset tummies. But that reaction that they've had can be a bit hit and miss. It doesn't have to be every single time. It can be a very variable onset in terms of timing. And this is the same thing with EHS. It's not like a light switch going on and off. There's a very variable onset, and some people can have a reaction that's really quite delayed from the initial trigger. And there's lots of other reasons why these tests are very difficult to do in terms of reproducing the real exposure as well. Many of these studies we're doing using EMF that's actually nothing like using a real cell phone, and often not considering the individual patients and their individual reaction time. But despite this, some have had a clear reaction when they did not know that the EMF was there, so it couldn't possibly have been psychological. In addition to this, we look at animal and plant studies. Animals obviously can't scare themselves by reading newspaper articles about the worries of mobile phones, and yet there are a number of animal studies showing avoidance behaviours as well as biological stresses in animals when they're exposed, even plants, and they're definitely not scared. So the other thing, of course, we have to come back to is if we have these plausible biological mechanisms like oxidative stress, again, shows us that there are physical aspects to this happening. This is just to give you a reference to one of the papers that shows a reaction under double-blinded conditions. Now, moving forward, by looking into the evidence at an expert level, some groups like this one, and I want to thank them because this is really important, the Europa EMF guideline of 2016 was put together to help medical doctors. So those medical doctors in the audience, this was a guideline put together to help you diagnose and give good advice to patients who are having acute, that is rapid onset, responses to everyday EMF exposures. So another useful reference for you. And it's no surprise, given that these exposures are increasing and the evidence is increasing, that we are seeing globally successful legal actions in this arena. So EHS people are being increasingly recognised in many countries, including the UK. In some cases, they are disabled and need to be either compensated or pensioned or just given the provision of a low EMF environment so that they can continue their work or go to school. So we like to look at large volumes of literature, and I've already mentioned how strong the literature on oxidative stress is. Dr. Henry Lai, who works for the Bioinitiative Working Group, has done many large literature reviews over the years, and this one I found interesting, along with this one, that both show that about 70% of studies were showing biological effects. Now, the reason I found this interesting was that they did a separate analysis and found that if you only looked at the results of studies that were funded by a related industry, let's say the telecommunications industry, then these figures were turned on their head. So 70% of people said there wasn't really a problem, 30% said, oh, it looks like there may be an issue. Now, I don't find that very reassuring either. Even if we only looked at what we would consider conflicted or biased literature, that still leaves us with this really substantial number of papers showing that there's a real issue here. But of course, we try not to look at conflicted literature. We want to look at that from unbiased sources. The problem is it's increasingly difficult to find any groups who actually don't have some level of conflict when it comes to the use of telecommunications because it's so entirely ubiquitous. Now, I mentioned the Bioinitiative Working Group just now because Henry Lai is a member of that and he's done lots of these reviews. But they're a really well-trained group. They have three former presidents of the Bioelectromagnetics Society, and they've done many reviews over the years. So in 2012, they found all of these outcomes. I won't talk through all of them. But the reason I'm drawing your attention is, again, for references. So you can find whole tables like this one of the low-intensity effects. And these are all effects that have been found below current guideline exposures, and there are many, many of them, not simply what I've crammed onto this slide. So a great source for you finding the original literature and seeing how prolific it is. In 2014, when they looked at over 5,000 studies, they made some of these very important statements, saying that sensitive populations in the adult community needed to be protected, but also that we should absolutely be preferring hardwired connections in school in order to protect our vulnerable children. Now, because we've been talking about electromagnetic hypersensitivity, I just want to mention this. We've looked at numbers of papers showing effect for oxidative stress. He also did a review looking at effect versus no effect papers for neurological effects. And neurological effects, I mentioned, are quite strong in the literature. And in this particular look, he found that 72% of papers were showing effect out of over 300 papers. Now, we talked a lot about acute effects, things that happen in short spaces of time, and the classic symptoms I've mentioned, headache, palpitations, sleep disturbance, skin rashes in some cases, tinnitus. These are all some of the common symptoms reported. But anything that causes acute issues, whether it's symptomatic or on a biological level, if that's unmanaged and it continues, we see this movement from acute illness into chronic or long-term health effects. And of course, we have biomarkers for the different phases of these areas. And for some, we never move to chronic illness because acute illness itself is a terminal event. So some of the symptoms I've mentioned, you know, palpitations, that we see, do see arrhythmia deaths in children. Seizures, status epilepticus can kill some children. But let's say we get beyond acute illness and that just goes grumbling on for a long time. What are some of the chronic effects that are demonstrated in the literature? So I want to draw your attention to something that has been found in a good number of papers now as well, which is DNA damage. So this was a study that was EU funded from what's called the REFLEX. It was a REFLEX study. And on the left there, you'll see a healthy ball of DNA. So this is DNA that has not had any kind of toxic exposure. It looks like a sun, a beautiful sun. In the middle there, you'll see DNA that's been irradiated with the equivalent of about 1,600 chest x-rays. And that comet-like tail, this is called a comet assay, because that comet-like tail is DNA fragmentation, damaged pieces of DNA. And then on the far right here, this is 24 hours of mobile phone radiation. And you can see below the current allowable exposure, and you can see how that comet-like tail of damage is really comparable to this really substantial amount of ionizing radiation, which we know is implicated in biological damage and potentially cancer. So a number of studies, just chose this one because they had a nice graphic, but a number of studies have shown this DNA damage. And we've made a comment, so back to this paper that I referenced to you at the beginning from ICBE. In our fact sheet, we point out that there has been shown increased risk of brain tumour in a number of studies now, and this has been reinforced by animal studies looking at mobile phone or base station exposure in animals. So the International Agency for Research on Cancer, they're the group broadly that designate whether something is a carcinogen or not. And that is an evolving process. So they, depending on the evidence level, they can put it in a number of categories. They can say it's not carcinogenic, or it might be, it's possibly carcinogenic, which is group 2B, or it's probable, which is group 2A, or it is a known established human carcinogen. And this type of radiation in our wireless devices was categorized as a group 2B possible human carcinogen back in 2011, and it has not been reassessed since that time. One of the reasons that they didn't designate RF in a higher category was because they said, well, we've seen increases in certain types of human brain tumours in heaviest users. People have used a phone, for example, for more than 10 years. And I want to thank Leonard Hardell and colleagues who put together some very important research that underpinned this category. And also the interphone showed increased tumour types, glial cell tumours, in the heaviest users. So those were gliomas. And there was also some evidence of a particular type of tumour called a schwannoma. In this case, with cell phone use, it was what we call an acoustic neuroma, or a vestibular schwannoma. It means it's in the ear, it's in the ear nerve, which is not surprising because that's where the highest intensity of radiation from your phone falls. And on the basis of this increased noting of brain tumours in the brain, they said, well, we have to categorise this as group 2B. We think it might be causing cancer in humans, but to be sure and give it a probable category or a known category, we need to see this in animals as well. And because things that cause cancer in humans, when you study them correctly, cause cancer in animals. And so this was the evidence they wanted, along with some mechanisms. Those steps, I said, between A and B, well, we're seeing more brain tumours in these heavy users, but we want to know how they get there. And that's what they need to give it a higher category. So this NTP study, National Toxicology Program in the US, this is their raison d'etre. What they do is they look at toxicology with a particular emphasis on carcinogenesis. So they were commissioned to do a study. Do we see the same types of cancers when we expose animals to this kind of radiation? This was their result. They found the highest possible evidence category, that is clear evidence of heart schwannoma, And I'm hoping you remember that word schwannoma, because it's the same tumour type. It's not necessarily a common tumour. This would be highly unlikely to be an accidental finding. That would be very illogical to think this isn't linked. And again, brain glioma, they found some evidence of that. So at this point, there was this enormous corroboration of the data that had already been found from human epidemiological studies. Now, some criticize, when findings like this are published, there's always very heavy criticism because it's not popular. This is not what anybody wants to hear. So one of the criticisms was used quite in high intensities for these animals. They had whole body exposure, by the way, which is why we see the schwannoma in the heart rather than in the ear, because they weren't using sulfates for their ear. But some said, well, this is a very high exposure. Now, the truth is, when you put a sulfate directly against your ear, that is a high-intensity exposure. And their low category was well within the amount that a heavy user could be experiencing from a phone. So they defended the study very well, saying, no, this is a realistic exposure. However, after this was published, we had this study, which is the Ramazzini Institute study. And this was looking at base station radiation, so emulating a mast a long way away, with much lower intensity exposures. And this was one of the largest scale studies ever done looking at animal cancers in response to that kind of radiation. What did they find? They found the same histotypes, the same cell types of tumour again. So at this point, the evidence was very substantially strengthened. And now you might say, well, are we seeing the tumour rises? Now, these are quite, thankfully, quite rare tumours. However, we have seen, there is some evidence that these types of tumours are rising in young people in the UK. And this was published by Alistair Phillips et al. Some years ago. And we wouldn't necessarily expect these tumours to keep rising. And there are a number of reasons why. One of them is that we've actually stopped generally using phones to our head nearly as much, especially young people. You'll see them all texting. They hold the phone here against their abdomen and pelvis, or here, nearer to their thorax. But actually, the trend has moved very much. But something else has moved as well, and that's the antenna in the phone. So antennae used to be up here, and they've moved down here. And there are increasing concerns that now we're seeing more thyroid cancers, parotid tumours, that may be linked to this movement in the antenna of the phone. But this group, again, very prestigious, and I want to say thank you to Anthony Miller, who has an exemplary career and a very strong, incredible voice on this subject. He put together this very important paper that pointing out that in this group's opinion, and this is a while ago now, I think this paper was 2018 now, I have to look, but they felt that this should be recategorized as a group one known human carcinogen. But IARC have not yet re-evaluated that science. Now, in terms of vulnerabilities of children, I mentioned at the beginning their unique anatomy and physiology and tissue dielectrics can all mean that they actually have a physically higher dose in their brain. And you'll find a reference for this again in our ICBE publication. But we see these increased doses even in substructures like the hippocampus of the brain. You'll find references for all of those statements. And this is modelling that shows how much more deeply through the brain of a child we would expect this radiation to penetrate when compared with an adult. Now, you might say to yourself, hang on, if the International Agency for Research on Cancer is concerned that brain cancer may be caused by radiofrequency radiation, and brain tumours in young people have increased, then why on earth are we not being warned to restrict their use? The answer is, on some level, you are being. So this is just an NHS website, which I'll blow up the relevant part here. The UK Chief Medical Officers advise that children and young people under 16 should be encouraged to use their mobile phones. It's interesting how industry-friendly that language is, but encouraged to use their mobile phones for essential purposes only, and keep calls short. This is a very important warning from a very incredible group. But what happened, because this was never disseminated, it wasn't disseminated to parents, to teachers. Schools often provide, they prescribe homework, sometimes on mobile phones. What happened here? And most important of all, this was not conveyed to children. Children and young adults can have enormous capacity to understand that something's harmful to them and they should not be using it unless they absolutely have to. And then we have to ask ourselves, I think, what is killing our children more than anything? And these statistics I find extremely sad, and they changed. I keep a watch on these statistics over the years, and this is statistics in girls. You see the highest cause of death up here is suicide and poisoning. And but also malignant neoplasms of the brain up there in the top handful, I would say. And then in boys, again, suicide. And certain cancers are rising in children, a number of different ones, some of which have been linked in the literature to EMF exposures and some of which not necessarily. But the point is, with this huge and rising number of children opting out of life when they're so young, we need to think to ourselves, could there be any link with this? Because it's this kind of exposure has risen in the same time period. And the question is, the point is, we're not sure, but yes, it is possible, because it has been shown to alter brain physiology in a number of studies. And one of the mechanisms I showed you on that early mechanism slide involved calcium channels and in general, iron channels in the brain. So we have channels in the cell membrane that let ions like calcium, sodium, potassium in and out of the cell. And EMF has been shown in some studies, and I would point you to the work of Dimitris J. Panagopoulos. There's some multiple publications explaining this mechanism in great detail, where he shows that these channels can be falsely gated or activated by electromagnetic fields of the types that we have in our common devices. And this paper, following on from that important mechanistic work, points out that this could credibly lead to neuropsychiatric disturbance. So classically, you might think of that as being the points on the left. You'll notice that the other points that come under neuropsychiatric disturbance are actually classically EHS, electromagnetic hypersensitivity. But this one, depression, this is a terminal illness for some children. And so we have to take an approach, I think, that this is the kind of situation where there is doubt, there is no doubt. And I don't mean just looking at a depression point of view, but when you look at all of the different biological effects that could be happening, if this is leading to very negative outcomes in our children, we need to take a different approach. And on that note, I want to say thank you to a small town in Ireland that decided to ban smartphones from children. Now, to be fair, this kind of decision is usually taking place at the moment based on more the content of phones and the distraction of phones and all of the myriad of social media problems that children are absolutely undeniably struggling with. And that is a separate issue to the radiation. And thank you to this group of teachers who were behind this and were overwhelmed by the important support they got from parents saying, yes, you know what, we are seeing up close and personal the negative effect on our children. We're behind you. We want to stop them using these devices. And whole governments are taking this on board. So this is in Northern Ireland, saying new guidance to limit phone use in Northern Irish schools. And one of the biggest academy trusts in England is also saying the same thing. This is moving very fast now. We're seeing more and more mainstream schools taking the decision to ban smartphones. But again, they're doing it more because of the content and the distraction side, from what I can tell. But I bring this in to ask this question. When they ban those phones, when they take them away and say, we don't want these in our classroom, where do they go? Because it's actually very easy to fulfill this question, where there's doubt, there's no doubt, let's protect them. If you're taking phones away anyway, why not pop them in a Faraday box for the day? Because then they're also not exposing the children to radiation. So it's a simple thing to do. And we also need to be consistent, don't we? Because it's one thing to say, well, we don't want children... let's go with the chief medical officers who said, we think children should only use phones for essential purposes. And that was based on radiation. That was because of uncertainties, in inverted commas, about the radiation, not to do with the social media side. Now, if you're going to say to a child, well, we don't want you using that phone, you have to be consistent and look at the other sources of RF radiation in their life. So tablets. Tablets can have a very comparable, sometimes even higher, specific absorption rate to a phone, and it's used very close to the body. And this has been neglected because that original data that I told you about, that was about brain tumours, where they're using the phone close to the head. But we don't know what happens when you move that exposure to the abdomen and pelvis, but some abdominal and pelvic tumours appear to be rising in young groups. And we simply don't know yet whether this is playing a role, but we have to be suspicious that it could be based on the other data and take that seriously. And so we should be using the same cautions for other devices like iPads that also use very close to the body. Now, let's say that everyone accepts, okay, you know what, let's not give our children devices that emit radiation and to use close. But a lot of people say, yeah, but we do want to use Wi-Fi. The adult groups in the school want to use Wi-Fi. So we're going to just keep the routers on and we'll move them away from the children. I would caution against that as your solution. And the reason I say that is because of a number of things. So first of all, what you're talking about there is intensity. When you're talking about how far away something is, you know, the router and the device are doing the same thing, really. They're both communicating data from each other. So they're both little routers, really. And the difference is that one is further away. And that is very important because the intensity you receive is inversely proportional to the square of the distance. In short form, the closer it is, the intensity you receive is much, much higher. So there is absolutely some common sense in that approach. But some studies have actually shown intensity windows, we call them, but enhanced biological damage from lower intensities than higher ones. So that's one complicating factor. In addition to that, certain frequencies seem to be more bioactive than others. And again, it's not necessarily a simple recipe that you might expect where the higher the frequency, the more damage. No, it's not that simple. Different body tissues absorb different frequencies and intensities differently. So that's another complicating factor. Then we have to think of cumulative exposure, a bit like cigarette smoking. Maybe a low intensity of radiation can have a very significant effect if they're in it for a long period of time. And the answer is that a lot more work needs to be done on cumulative exposures, because that's reality. All of us, if we're in the modern world, have exposures that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in many cases. Think of the cumulative exposure of that over time, even if the intensity is low. And almost, you know, very few studies have been done looking at that and looking at it well. Then we need to look at the type of signal, the morphology of that signal, because smooth sine waves that are continuous, some studies show that these pulse information-carrying waves that have a very sawtooth up and down, rapidly changing profile, that can be more irritating to cells in some studies. The polarity may be important. And, of course, looking in a totally different way, but in a real-life situation, many of the studies that have looked at this have one source of electromagnetic radiation coming from one emitter in an otherwise shielded room. What happens when you have 30 phones in a classroom, several routers in a building, and a load of metal things that they're all bouncing off? When you get reflected fields, it's even easier to get what we call constructive interference. So where the increased intensity coincides with the wave that looks similar and you get an increase overall. And those, because of these complex signals, those are ever-changing in time and space. You can't even measure them easily. And we're really lacking in good measuring devices that catch these very high data spikes that are happening, especially with the newer technology. So it's way more complex than simply saying we move something away, the intensity is lower, therefore everything's okay. It's just not that simple if you look at the real science. Now I want to take a breath and a pause for a moment, because I've spoken a lot for a long time and I've spoken with a lot of science and biology. What I want to do now is, I recognise that there are some very well qualified people in the audience. We have some people with a scientific and medical background, but we have an even larger number of people who don't have that kind of background at all. And it must be extremely hard to try and decide whether you need to take this seriously or not when you're bombarded with different messages from different groups in terms of the science. And one of the things that I think is helpful for you to do when you're presented with that situation is look collaterally at the other evidence surrounding you. Now, it's interesting that more litigation is being won on this subject. So several court cases have been won now in Italy in the Supreme Court, showing that there was a ruling that brain tumours were indeed caused by the mobile phone used by the subject. But in addition to that, I think this goes a very long way. Insurance companies are risk analysts. Their livelihood depends on it. They do it really, really well. And I am not personally aware of any underwriters who currently will indemnify for the health effects of radiofrequency radiation. I'm not aware of any. So this is Swiss Re in their report that they titled 5G off the leash. And they're expecting high impact risks affecting property and casualty claims after 5 years of deployment. And this is how these things evolve. This is how they begin. And this is a legal firm that offers no win, no fee assistance to Wi-Fi injury claims. This is something I put together many, many years ago now, but I thought about it from, again, a very simplistic point of view. But I thought, well, with our children, we care so much. If they take a step outside the school grounds, as a parent, you usually need to fill out a consent form. And in the medical world, when I worked in the hospital, we had to use consent forms for anything that could possibly cause harm. And we had to receive informed consent. That was very, very important. It wasn't enough to say, are you okay if I do this to you? We had to explain the risks, and we had to explain the benefits, because it is a risk versus benefit equation. And I thought about this in that humble forum, and how would you construct a consent form for this? And you would have to say, if you're being fair and reasonable, I consent to my child being irradiated by a Group 2B possible human carcinogen and exposed to radiation shown to cause DNA damage and other biological disruptions such as reproductive impairment, neurological disruption, cardiovascular compromise, impaired learning ability, hormonal disruption, etc. There's so much more that we could put on this slide. And I think that makes people feel really uncomfortable. But this process has never been gone through. We've just never had the debate. And parents are generally very, very detached from the actual scientific literature on this subject. And I said this is a risk versus benefit equation. It is exactly that. I mean, to be fair, we do take risks with our children and with ourselves all the time. Every time you seat your child in a car and drive them to school, you're taking a substantial risk. Road traffic accidents used to be one of the highest causes of death. And we do that. We make that assessment as parents. We calculate that and decide what's in their interest and what isn't. But what's fascinating to me is this risk assessment has just never happened in schools. Because I'm not suggesting you can't make a case that there are specific instances where the use of wireless communication is of enormous benefit. However, for teaching children in a classroom, you cannot make that case. I challenge anyone to make that case. This is from the OECD, and it's not even talking about the use of wireless radiation. They're just talking about use of computers, saying that actually using computers doesn't really help kids learn. Now, I'm not saying there aren't specific circumstances where very specific things can be taught very well by computers. Absolutely, they can. But overall, how do our children learn best? If I was giving you all this information right now in some kind of pre-recorded presentation with stuff coming up on the screen, it's highly likely that actually you would retain a fraction of it compared with being here and seeing me speak with the enthusiasm I most definitely have for this subject. This is how our children learn. They need to see a human face that has some passion and variation in their tone and engages them in a real life space. That is how our children learn best, and we all know it. If you quit your job and had a robot teaching your children from a parenting point of view, you know it wouldn't work the same way. So there's question marks about the use of computers, and of course we need them in very strategic ways, but we need to analyse where they work and where they don't. And then we need to analyse how that information is reaching the child, and there is absolutely no way that you need to have radio frequency radiation to deliver online material to your child. That's archaic. The most developed groups on the planet, the guys in Silicon Valley, the military, they use hardwired connections that deliver the internet with zero radiation. Now, we mentioned before some of the surrounding effects, the distraction, the effects on sleep, the content. And I want to, this is a very experienced and well-written gentleman who is from Ireland, Tom Butler, and I think this is an excellent piece of writing that again has a great many references that look at this from very many angles, bringing in the other aspects of technology use and how they affect children in a detrimental way. One thing that I haven't touched on, we're not going to go into great detail here, is you'll remember at the beginning I said even the group who set the guidelines, who say they're okay, ICNIRP, they did mention this concern. What happens when you put it together with another toxicant in the environment? We can have this synergistic effect. So that can happen with chemicals. There's a number of papers now showing co-carcinogenic effects. That means that EMF can enhance the cancer-causing properties of certain chemicals. It can interact with other forms of EMF. So I've talked about the possibility for constructive interference, but also other frequencies like the household wiring that we talked about, like the high voltage power lines. What happens when you overlap these electromagnetic fields? Because they are now so complex in our environment. And actually, one of the reasons that the groups in the military and in Silicon Valley prefer hardwired networks and are not using radio frequency for much of their communication is because you get better data security and equipment longevity. These are high-tech decisions. These aren't Luddite decisions to move to a healthier way of delivering your internet. So on that optimistic level, in terms of moving forward, we need accountability, we need acceptance, we need to be looking at this properly. And in terms of our publication with ICBE, we are saying we do not feel the current guidelines are properly protecting our young groups, but also not our adult groups, and also not the animals that surround us. So all of these animals, land dwellers, these aquatic species, these aviators, are all perhaps prejudicially affected in that they have specific types of cells called cryptochromes and magnetite that can be very sensitive. They can use the natural electromagnetic fields for essential life purposes. And so there may be particularly damaging effects in wildlife communities. And this has not been factored in at any point into our current safety guidelines. Nobody considered the other biology on our planet at the time that these antennae were deployed. Now, I'd be really sad to walk out of here today and think that you felt that I was a sort of lone voice on this, because there are so many groups and increasing numbers as awareness increases that are speaking out on this. Groups of doctors, groups of scientists, really well-qualified people with various declarations and resolutions and appeals from all over the world, and these are just a few of them. For my 2 cents worth, I put this document together a few years ago, called it the 2020 Consensus Statement, and we had a number of doctors' groups who are trying to educate themselves on this subject, who signed this declaration. I said educate themselves because, as I said at the beginning, this is not part of medical teaching programs at this point. Oh, and that declaration, that statement is still open for signing, so if any of you want to sign that, you can. And in terms of moving forward, it's not rocket science. If we're concerned that these exposures are causing biological effects, the first thing we do is reduce the exposures. And thank you to the American Academy of Pediatrics, who put together some really important and strong statements, pointing out, for example, that children should be protected in schools with hardwired connections. And this from the Cypress Medical Association and Austrian Medical Chambers. This is a really strongly written document that points out carcinogenicity, the cancer properties of this, as we've mentioned, developmental neurotoxicity, effects on DNA, fertility, electromagnetic hypersensitivity. They point out this is occurring below the current safety guidelines and that damages could be serious and in some cases irreversible. Moving on, they talk about schools and the fact that we should be favouring hardwired connections. And they want to see parents empowered to demand a safe environment at their home and school. So on a practical level, it's very important to me that I don't just talk to you about the problems, that I offer you solutions, because there are so many solutions. This can be really well done in schools. And we start by, at the beginning of this discussion, I was really pleased that the organisers talked about putting your phones in flight mode, and it gave me an opportunity to point out that actually flight mode no longer disables all of the radio frequency emissions from your phone. You have to sometimes separately disable the Bluetooth and Wi-Fi and some of the others like Apple Pay. You have to turn those off separately sometimes. And when you're looking at computers and tablets, You can also put those into flight mode, but again, you normally need to separately disable the emissions that you want to through your control panel. So you disable your computer, then you disable your router. That can be more complex and you need to speak to your provider. And unfortunately, I do need to point out that actually you may need a meter to do this successfully, an EMF meter, because I cannot count how many times, and I've listened to some of these conversations in progress, the providers will tell you that the router is switched off because it can't access internet wirelessly, but it is nonetheless still emitting, and I've been able to demonstrate that with the router. So, with a meter. So you do need to check that when you think something is switched off, it actually is, because it's increasingly common that it looks like it is, but in fact it's still emitting. And I can talk through some of the processes for that at the end if you'd like to. I've mentioned here grounding the systems, because that's to talk about the extremely low frequency fields, the power frequency fields. They can be quite high when a child is very near to a plugged-in computer. Some computers are really well grounded, and that's not an issue, but others are not well grounded at all. So that is something we should absolutely be thinking about, even when children are on hardwired computers where the radio frequency is disabled. Colour-changing software, I think many of you are aware of the issues with blue light. And so reducing blue light, and there's a number of ways of doing it, from screens that screen out blue light that go on top of your screen, or colour-changing software that can all help. But overall, we should just be limiting screen time, because there's this myriad of different health effects that are all related. Children should have very judicious use of screens for well-proven applications. And that just talks about how to disable your phone. But also I want to mention debt or cordless landlines, because in some cases these emit radio frequency continuously, whether you're using them or not, from both the handset and the base station itself. And many people sleep with these next to their bed. And here again it is a situation where having a meter is really, really useful, because it allows you to see exactly what in your house is emitting RF radiation. You'll be astonished at how many things are that you never thought of, like your television or your security system or your keys for your car or your smartwatches. And smartwatches can be surprisingly aggressive and continuous EMF emission that I was surprised to see. So I've put together a few leaflets on my website, Physicians Health Initiative for Radiation and Environment, firemedical.org, to just help people to take the first very basic steps to reduce their own exposure, and that for the people around them at home. But these can also be used by premises like doctor's surgeries or restaurants or a growing number of different public places, so that they can then proudly say, we've taken steps to try and reduce your unnecessary exposures and make this more welcoming to people who are sensitive or just don't want to be exposed. And that's the other side of that leaflet. This is one that's specifically about Wi-Fi in schools, but I'll move through these quickly. And this is just to point out that when it comes to the specific situation of school, I don't like to see half measures. I think it's very important that we start in steps and say, well, what can we get rid of first? What can we reduce second? And that's to keep everyone's psychology manageable. I think that's really sensible. But what we should be aiming for is actually to eradicate these exposures in school, because we can. We can. And so where there's doubt, there's no doubt that we should just protect children. And if one day we find that this was all not necessary, we can take a big sigh of relief and say, isn't that great? But I hope I've shown you enough evidence to justify my position, which is that this is absolutely not acceptable, that we are making preventable, regrettable decisions right now that we need to reverse as quickly as possible. We can remove and we can replace using hardwired connections, and we can reduce using shielding for the emissions that are outside of the building and therefore potentially beyond our control. So very quickly, we need to be doing this in school and moving towards a healthier environment for children. And some countries have come a long way in starting to do that already, as I've pointed out. So we're coming towards the end of my slides, and I just want to summarise by saying these non-thermal or low-intensity biological effects are happening below the current safety exposure guidelines. And we need to revise those guidelines. We need to revise them to take into account paediatric populations and hypersensitive groups, and just generally for everyone else, be protecting against biological damage, which they currently are not. We are seeing rises in some related multi-systemic diseases, and children are especially vulnerable for a long list of reasons. And most importantly, we can mitigate these risks immediately using hardwired connections. So these are some points of action being taken up by my group FIRE. And I want to point you towards further resources, because these are some really great websites where you will find more literature than you can possibly cope with in terms of the peer-reviewed publications from scientists and medical doctors on this issue. And on that note, I want to thank all of the brilliant people that I work with in all of these different organisations. Thank you so much for listening, and I'm very happy to take questions from the audience and answer them as best I can.